Here at Perimeter Institute, probably you all have my email address. I know that some of you have been emailing me, so I definitely know that you have my email address. Well, first of all, let me welcome you to Perimeter, or remotely to Perimeter, okay? I hope you guys here won't get distracted by the TV here, okay? So you're supposed to be paying attention to the screen and to the blackboards, not to what our friends are doing over there, okay? And, well, let me tell you the reason we decided to do this. The reason is that we are doing all this amazing and very exciting physics here, and we decided to share it with you guys. So this is the very first experiment that we're doing. It's an experiment because somehow it's a very ambitious project, right? We are going to try to cover everything that we do here in this building in only 12 weeks, okay? So, yes. Yes. Excellent. Cool. Well, at the moment, I'm not showing anything in the computer. I think that for today, we will have to go from one to the other one, okay? From the blackboard to the computer. Yes, yes. So it's going to, yes. As far as I know, today it's going to take 3 seconds to go from the computer to the blackboard. So Owen is going to try to talk. When he's using the blackboard, he's going to try to use the blackboard for a while, and then he's going to try to use the computer for a while so that we make the shift and you guys don't get confused, okay? Okay, very good. So I was saying that this is a very ambitious project, okay? And it would require, for its success, it would require a very important commitment for you guys. And in order to help you out with the commitment, the way this course is going to be evaluated is just by homework problems, okay? So you will have problem sets. And so that you don't fall behind the course, each problem set is going to be ideally handed out to you during the first lecture of the speaker. And it's going to be due the first lecture of the next speaker, okay? So in other words, the homework for this part of the course is going to be due when the string theory part of the course starts in 2 weeks, okay? Or, well, in 3 weeks if you push it all the way to the Tuesday when this thing starts. And solutions will be posted the day after the problem set is due. So you guys will have to keep up and try to finish the problem set on time, because after the solutions are posted, of course, we cannot receive the solutions. We cannot receive problem sets anymore. So I gave you, and perhaps Eric also did over there, I gave you the description of the course. You can find in the web page all the information. All problem sets will be posted there. You can also find the schedule and every information that you need, everything that you need to know about the course is over there. You will now be able to find all the speakers, when they are giving the talks, the topics, everything is on the web page, okay? So the solutions will also be posted there, okay? Well, I can only say that the group of postdocs who are going to be teaching this, this course are experts in their areas, and, well, they are very well known. And today, let me introduce Owen, who will be talking about quantum foundations of quantum mechanics. Okay, very good.
Well, I'd better answer that. So there's two things I probably need to say to start off. Firstly, is the plan is that the assignments will be handed out on the first lecture of the course. You have not actually received my assignment yet. The reason is because it's not going to be handed out today. A bit too soon after Christmas. It will be going up on the website tomorrow, and I will have paper copies on Thursday for those people who can't go to the website. As far as the slides that are being presented, pretty much a summary of the slides will, for all my talks, will certainly be placed on the website. I can't guarantee that for all lectures. You'll just have to ask each lecturer in turn. However, what is going on the blackboard you might want to take notes about. So the topic I'm going to be talking about is a strange topic called the foundations of quantum theory. And this isn't mathematical physics, and it's not philosophy. It's about understanding what quantum theory means. So I believe you've all done a certain number of courses in which you'll have been taught how to do calculations in quantum mechanics. And the tradition in teaching these courses is to say at some point people go, well, hang about, that's rather weird. And people will give you experiments, and they'll draw diagrams of Young slit experiments and talk about bullets and electrons and diffraction patterns. And saying, well, in the end of the day, it's all really weird, but you know, don't worry about it, just do some calculations. And the field of foundations of quantum theory is kind of people who feel that that's not really good enough. We ought to really try and understand what this means. And it turns out that it's not just questions in philosophy. It actually, it does lead to real physical experiments that are done. And today I'm going to be talking about some of those experiments. So the kind of questions we actually do worry about are, you know, what actually makes something, when we say quantum mechanics, well, what specifically about observed things that happen? Is it that makes us say, this thing's quantum, this isn't classical? And what kind of physical process can account for that? I mean, how can we understand these things taking place? If the world is so quantum and quantum mechanics is so weird, well, then how is it that the world looks so quite classical and so not weird? And finally, towards the end of this, we're going to actually say, well, could it be different? And one of the things about quantum foundations is that we try to actually be very conceptually clear. We don't like hand-wavy arguments, say, maybe it's a bit like this. We want to say, what do you mean by that? If you're using this phrase or this word in this context, what exactly do you mean? And the structure of this, I'm going to be giving four lectures on this. Firstly, I'm just actually going to be talking about quantum phenomena. And that's going to be looking at the kind of interference experiments in the double slits. I'm going to go a bit beyond the kind of the standard, here's the double split, here's the interference patterns, isn't that strange? I'm going to also talk about some of the actual experiments that have been done testing this. On Thursday, I'm going to deal with one of the kind of the notorious problems that gets talked about in quantum mechanics. It often gets referred to as the measurement problem. This is usually associated with a cat and worrying about whether or not a cat is alive or dead. I am not actually going to mention cats at all. I am going to say that you can understand this problem without ever caring about cats. The next week, the next most notorious aspect of foundations of quantum theory is something called non-locality, and about a conflict or a possible conflict between relativity theory and quantum theory. Again, I'm going to try and actually give an introduction to this and just say, well, you know, what exactly is the problem here? There's been a lot of different attempts to actually view these. And I'm going to actually just give an introduction to these. And then in the fourth lecture, I'm going to go crazy and say, well, you know, maybe quantum theory is wrong. Maybe, you know, our quantum mechanics isn't actually the final theory, and there's going to be some other theory. But whatever that other theory is, it's going to have the same job of explaining quantum phenomena, because the phenomena we identified as saying quantum phenomena, that's just things we've seen. It's facts about the way the world behaves. Any future theory that replaces quantum mechanics is also going to have to explain those same facts, because those facts are just facts. They don't depend on the theory. So when we try and actually understand what kind of physical process can actually be responsible for quantum phenomena, part of the reason for that is because, well, maybe quantum mechanics is going to be wrong. Those physical processes might be giving us a glimpse of what some future theory might be that one day replaces quantum theory. Maybe. Because maybe all that's actually just idle speculation and quantum theory is right. So, one of the things I have to actually say about this is there are many different points of view that get taken on some of these questions. So I'm not going to be able to do something exhaustive about this. What I'm going to try and do is give you a fairly fair and unbiased introduction to some of these ideas. Unfortunately, there isn't any kind of textbook I can refer to you. There are many, many textbooks on quantum theory. The ones that talk about foundations usually relegate it to an appendix and get it wrong. That's just the way it is. I can, however, recommend a number of advanced books if you are interested that you can go on to read, which I will do. Now, one of my colleagues, Philip Goyal, will later on in the term follow on from this, following on, in a sense, from Beyond the Quantum, and he will give two lectures that are about going into more detail in some approaches to quantum theory. Right, well, first of all, I'm just going to actually write some things on the blackboard. So if we move over to the blackboard here, taking 3 seconds to switch. So there's going to have to assume that you know certain things about quantum theory. And we'll start off by saying, well, suppose there's a wave function, and we suppose that we have a system, and it's a quantum system, it's an atom or a photon, and we're describing it by a wave function psi of x. Well, first thing I'm assuming you know is that if we want to say what's the probability of finding, we look for that atom somewhere. We go out and we try and search for it, where it is. What's the probability of finding it in some region dx? Then it's the magnitude squared of that wave function times dx. And we can tell something about psi x straight away from that is that, well, if we look everywhere, then we're basically integrating over all space. Well, if we look everywhere and we know there is an atom, then we better find it somewhere. So the probability it better be 1. So that tells us that this wave function is what we call normalized. Now the next thing is, we might not be looking for the location of the atom as being in some place in space. We might be doing something else. We start off with the atom in some wave function, some state psi, and then we say, what's the probability of finding it in a different state? So we've got some different state, which I'm going to note phi. And to work out what's the probability of finding it in this state psi, phi, given that we prepared it in state psi, then first of all, we just evaluate a complex value. So first of all, we just integrate the product of the complex phi with psi over all x. That gives us a number, a complex number. And the next thing we say about the quantum mechanics is, well, the probability of finding it in state phi, given that we prepared it to be in the state psi, is just given the magnitude of that complex number squared. And that's what we're going to start with. A little later on, we're going to get a bit more complicated. But for now, we're just going to go with that. So going back to the screen. So we look at an interferometry experiment. And this is the famous double slit experiment. And what we have is we have some source. And photons are coming out, or electrons are coming out, and they're shooting out of this source. And we prepared them in this state. And they come out, and we've got the screen, and we've got two slits in it, two holes. And what we describe this by is this superposition, where this is a wave function associated with the upper slit, and this is a wave function associated with the lower slit. And if we actually then try and apply what we've got here, well, we want to find out what's the probability of it arriving at this point of the screen. So we just do our probability of x, and we take our psi star and our psi, and if we actually put in this particular polar notation, where we say, well, this is a complex field, and we can write this as being a real field times complex number, which has got a phase. This is just called a polar decomposition. And if we put this in and we expand this out, we get this rather long, complicated pattern. But it's actually rather straightforward, and what's important about it is it has a cosine here. And this cosine term is responsible for this kind of oscillatory interference pattern. Well, and one of the important things about this is that at this point here, that pattern was zero. And what that means is, at that point there, the probability of our quantum object arriving at that point was zero. So if we have this condition, and we plug that condition into this bit here, we find we get zero. Well, so far so, hopefully not too unfamiliar. And the question that often gets raised is, well, look, is it the probability of the photon being at x or the probability of finding the photon at x? I said when I wrote things on the blackboard, we want to be very careful, I said, suppose we look for the atom. Where do we find it? The question is, where was the atom or the photon if I wasn't looking? And the usual one you might want to think is, well, it either went through there or it went through there, didn't it, before it got to the screen. So we start again and we look again at this and we go, oh, well, let's just find something out. Let's just block off one of the holes. And we'll see if we actually find it at this hole. So what does that mean? See if we find it at that hole. Well, we know how to do that because we just wrote it there. We can take the down wave function, I form this inner product, and I do this integration, and then I take the magnitude of that squared, and if we put all that in, we get a half. How do we know that? Because I normalized these. People happy with that? Good. Well, that's fine. Because then when we look at what happens, we get, now we have a new wave function, is this wave function, because it wasn't here, then it must have been here. And that means it's in that wave function. So now we look at that, and the probability is different. Well, that's not too surprising. We can run it the other way. We can block the upper hole. Now we find the probability of it being blocked by the upper hole, it's a half. It wasn't blocked by the upper hole, must have been the lower hole. And then we find we get a different pattern. But here's the point. Both of them have a non-zero probability of arriving at this point here. When we didn't have any hole blocked, well, if we had it just gone through there with probability one half, and then arrives with the probability it would have from going through there, through the upper hole. And then it goes through a lower hole with one half, and it arrives with the probability that it would have had it gone through the lower hole. Then you'd expect in total to have got a distribution that's just an addition of the two. Probability x given the upper hole times the probability of the upper hole, probability of x given down, lower hole, times probability of down, and simply we can calculate that. And it's just this average of the two, which is, of course, not what we saw. So the usual way things people say is, well, look, if we'd have blocked this up here, it can arrive there. But if we didn't block it up here, it can't arrive there. But if it was going to go through here, how did it know that was blocked so that it could arrive there because it had to know that it couldn't arrive there if that wasn't blocked, but it didn't go through that hole, it went through the other hole, because that hole was blocked. So at that point people go, well, that's weird, can't understand it, never mind, do some calculations. One of the assumptions we've actually made here, anybody has an idea of actually how we could actually get around this?
Well, there's a number of assumptions. One of the assumptions is that the probability it arrives at that screen, given it went through that hole, isn't affected by whether or not that one's blocked. Does that sound reasonable? First, it sounds reasonable, yes. But then again, that assumption leads to something that can't be true, isn't true, so maybe it's not.
Well, there's something else we can do with this. We can stick phase shifters in here. So instead of blocking the hole, what we do is we put a bit of a medium in there. So we've got a photon and we add a bit of a crystal in there. And it travels at a different rate, speed through the crystal. It's slowed down. And it does so, it picks up a phase. And we put a different crystal or a different width of crystal and the photon picks up a phase, but a different phase. So now our superposition has these phases attached. Well, we can calculate what the new probability is, and exactly as before, but now we find we've added these phases to it. So we find the interference pattern has shifted, and it's shifted by some function of these phases. Again, we can play the same kind of questions. We can say, well, look, it has to know not to arrive there. But to know that's the point it can't arrive at, it has to know the phase in both of them, because it's only the difference that tells us where it can't arrive. But if it only goes through one, then how can it know the phase in both? So it's got to go through both. What does that mean, it goes through both? And early on in the stages, one of the people called Bohr, one of the early developers of quantum theory, said, in any attempt at a pictorial representation of the behavior of the photon, we would thus meet with the difficulty. To be obliged to say on the one hand that the photon always chooses one of the two ways, and on the other hand that it behaves as if it had passed both ways. And what he means there is that if we look which one it passed through, we block it off, we see, bang, it actually that's there. If we block off both, we find that we detect it there or we detect it there, but we never get a detection at both places. But at the same time, if we don't detect it, we find that we get this interference pattern that depends upon what's going on in the region of both slits. And this isn't just a thought experiment. So here's an example of electron interference. So this is a genuine schematic for an actual attempt to actually get electron interference. And what we see here is actually an example of an interference pattern in electrons where they've introduced a phase-shifting effect. This particular phase-shifting effect is called the Aronoff-Bohm effect. And what you actually see is here we have the interference fringes. And then what happens here is they actually turn on this phase-shifting. And you can see how the interference fringes actually shift across and move. So it's not, you know, some obscure thing about going on that we kind of claim is happening but nobody's really checked. We've done it. We've checked and it happens. And this is a schematic for actually how they can do it with atoms. So here, it's a very good book on quantum optics, this. This is a case of where they got an atom and they used an atom and they separated the atom into two components. So they got the superposition of two distinct components in an atom. And then they actually did the experiment. 93 it actually took for the technology to develop enough for them to be able to do this. So they actually had an individual atom and it split up into two wave packets. This is exactly like the two slits. And then they bounced it off the mirror and then it recombined in another thing called a beam splitter. And the recombination of this is such that, well, when you actually include a whole bunch of phases, what you find is you get an interference fringes so that There's some probability of it arriving here and some probability of it arriving here. And when you add phase shifts here and here, you can vary which one it arrives. So you can pick a phase shift in the two branches here. And if you get the right phase shift between the two, you can make the zero probability of it arriving here. But the phase shift is the difference in phase between the two. So if the atom goes down one path, it picks up a phase shift. But it can't know which one it can't arrive at. Because to know which one it can't arrive at, it's got to know the phase shift in both. So it has to go through both. But if you look for it, if we stick a detector in here and actually say what happens, well, we find an atom here, or we find an atom here, but we never find two atoms, or half an atom, or anything like that at all. This one's really cool. This one is they did it with neutrons. You think that's... electrons are hard. Here, they did an experiment with neutrons. This was in the actual 70s. And to do it with neutrons, what they did was they actually got a block of a single perfect crystal. So then the neutron interfering would actually would be split up by going through the crystalline array. And this experiment was so sensitive, they're actually able to detect phase shift due to the gravitational field. Measuring whether or not the neutron arrives here or there. Well, so much so good. Now, we're going to make it a bit more complicated. There's a, the next step in describing this is, let's look for it. How do we look for it? We're going to shine a light. We're going to say, and this is down to Heisenberg, we're going to say, well, we're going to shine a light here, we're going to actually see which path it took. And the Feynman lectures give a very nice description of this. But broadly, the argument is that, well, to shine a light, you've got a photon. The photon actually has some kind of momentum by the de Broglie relationship. And that's going to affect the momentum of the particle, and it's going to cause this blurring. And when you get this blurring, then the interference disappears. So, is that what actually happens? Is it the fact that when you measure the momentum, you lose what the position is? Is it the problem here is that to find out what slit it went through, you have to change the transverse momentum? Well, let me go back to the blackboard and I'm going to write some extra stuff on it now. This is going to be what happens when we have two particles. If we have a system consisting of two quantum objects, I'm going to give them coordinates x and y, just to denote x is one object and y is the other. So we have the overall wave function for that object, and we say, well, what's the probability? We go out and we look across all space for both particles. And what's the probability of finding that one particle at position x and the other particle at position y? Well, that's not much different. We've just got a dx and a dy now. So what's the probability if we just forget about the second particle? We just look out over all space and we try and find the second particle, the first particle. Well, for that, we just want the probability of x. And to get that quite easily, what we do is we integrate over y. So we just don't bother caring about what happens to y. Well, that was one thing, but what's the next thing we wanted to see? When we said, here, we get, what happens if we look for the particle being in a particular state? So the next thing I'm going to say is, well, what do we get when we look for the particle, the second particle, to be in state phi y. So we're not going to look for both particles. We're just going to say, is the second particle in a state phi y? Now before, what we got was a complex value. What we're going to do is we're going to actually have now a complex function of x. And so first of all, we're going to get this complex function of x. So we're going to take the state we're looking for, and we're going to do this integration over the y. And what we get out here is a complex function of x. This is not, in general, normalized. That's going to be interesting. So, probability of finding it in phi y, given our initial wave function. Well, to get that, what we do is we take the magnitude squared of our new complex function, and we integrate that over all x. So it's kind of similar to our taking our alpha squared, but because it's a function, now we integrate over x. Suppose we do find it, there's the next question, suppose we do find it in phi y, what's now the state of the entire system? So now we have a new wave function. Well, it turns out that the new wave function is what we measured, and we looked and we found it in phi y, so it's definitely got the phi y part of it, but where's the x? Well, this chi function plays a, is what it is, but this chi function is not normalized, because if it was normalized, this would be 1, and that wouldn't be a very interesting probability. So we need the chi, but we need to organize, normalize it. And all that factor here is, this is just a number that makes sure that this particular function is normalized. So now we've got a new wave function. This is what we get after we've performed a measurement on the second wave function. So why have we had to introduce this? Well, because I'm going to do something involving new systems. What we're going to talk about, I'm going to involve now, is a device. It was a device developed by one of the people who worked on one of those slides I just showed you about experiments. It's called an optical QED cavity. And there's a lot of complicated details that I'm not going to bother go into, because what's important about this is, if you take an atom, you take an atom and the atom is in what we call an excited state, that means it's got a bit more energy than normal. And this is a very small, very, very small device that is tuned to the electromagnetic field to resonate at a very particular frequency. And the very particular frequency is the same frequency as the excited state of the atom. So there's the same amount of energy involved. So if you send the atom through this little box, what happens is, with probability damn close to 1, the atom goes to its ground state, so it gives up some energy. And it gives that energy up to the electromagnetic field, and it gives 1 unit of that energy, so it puts 1 photon in the box. So effectively what you start off is, you start off with an atom with some energy and a box that's empty. And you send the atom through, and what you get out is an atom that doesn't have much energy and a photon in a box, which is nice. But the important thing about this is, it doesn't have any significant effect on the momentum of the atom. You haven't shone a light on it, you haven't kicked it. And what these clever chaps did, said, well, let's put one of these in front of each of those slits. So they said, well, okay, we start off, we have our superposition of the atom. And it's in this excited state. And we've got these two boxes, one in front of the upper slit and one in front of the down slit. And at the moment, they're both empty. They've got no photons in them. Now, quantum mechanics, the evolution of quantum mechanics is linear. So, moving over to this blackboard, because I'm running out of blackboards. We start off with our initial state. What happens when the atom goes through the slits? One or both of them? Well, so we look at the upper slit, phi u. This will interact with the upper box, and it will transfer its photon into the upper box. But it won't interact with the lower box, so it won't do anything to that. And because it's transferred its photon, it's now in a ground state. And the upper box has a photon, and the lower box doesn't. But that's only half the story, because we've also got the atom that's going through the down slit. And this one, well, it's not going to interact with the upper slit. That's still not got a photon in it, but it does pass its photon into the down slit. So now we have, going back to the, when it arrives at the screen, we have this much more complicated wave function. And this doesn't factorize neatly. And this is, who knows what entanglement is? Be brave, come on. Who's heard the word entanglement? Hold your hand up. Who knows what entanglement is?
I've heard of it.
That's entanglement. That's the kind of situation. But what does that mean?
Well, we're going to spend about 3 lectures just worrying about what the hell that means.
That's an example of an entangled state. And where you have this, generally you've got this combination of different states summed up over different systems. What actually happens with that? Well, what we do is we wait, we record where the atom arrives at the screen. Then after we've recorded where the atom arrives at the screen, we go back and we say, where's the photon? Is it in the upper box or is it in the lower box? So this involves saying, well, what's the probability of getting this state? Photon in the upper box, not in the lower box. And we've written that over there. We do this calculation, which simply means we take this state here, and then we multiply it by this state, and we integrate. And what I haven't told you is that these states are what's called orthonormal. So I'll just briefly add that up. So we need to know this, is that what happens is that if we take these two, we take that, switching between blackboards and slides, never easy. So if we take this, and we want to put that into our integration, and we find we're going to get terms like this. And these terms turn out to be zero. What that means is saying that if you find the photon in the lower slit, and yeah, that was right. So, getting that right. What this is saying is, if you're finding the photon in the box below, there's no photon in the box above. And that itself isn't right either. Okay, this will be in the slides. Okay, this is correct. This is the wave function for the photon not being in the down box, and this is the wave function for the photon being in the down box. And the probability of it both being and not being in the down box is zero. This is the wave function for the photon being in the up box, and this is the wave function for the photon not, other way around, being in the up box, not being in the up box. And the probability of both being and not being in the up box is zero. Okay, so if you take those and you put them into our integral, what we find is that the probability is that, and that the wave function afterwards is that. So this is kind of a nice exercise for you all to work through. Prove this. Well, if you actually find out what the probability distribution is for our finding x, well, it just turns out it's this, squared. And that's not got interference in it. And we could have done it the other way around. The other option is, the other possibility also happens half the time, is we find photon down here, photon not down here. And now we find the wave function afterwards is that, and this doesn't have interference. Now this is very much like saying, the atom went through the upper slit, left its photon here, arrived here, and had that probability distribution. Or, the electron went through this path, left its photon here, not here, and arrived here. But what we didn't do is we didn't shine a light on it. We didn't do any kind of momentum transfer. What we got this entangled state. So, the simple story that says it's all about there being a momentum kick, that's not necessary. That's one way of finding out where the photon is. But it's not the atom is, but it's not the only way. What is true is if you try and find any way of finding out where it is, the interference appears to disappear. Now, there's one thing, have I mentioned here? The photon arrived at the atom arrived at the screen. We recorded the atom arriving at the screen. And then we went back to look. We often hear about wave function collapse when a measurement is performed. Was the measurement performed when we went and looked in the box? Or was the measurement performed when the atom arrived at the screen? Or was the measurement performed when the atom went through the box? Just think about that one. When did the wave function collapse? Just take a short break and have a kind of interesting thing about interferometry. There's genuinely been experiments. They haven't used bombs, by the way, but this idea was originally presented in terms of bombs. How to test for dub bombs? Suppose I've got a material. So material for making demolition. So I want to blow up buildings. It's not a bomb, it's just the blowing up buildings. But it's a really, really sensitive and explosive thing. So if you just hit it with a single photon, it blows up. Which is kind of dangerous, but, you know, same time, quite useful. The problem is the process that makes it has this tenth problem. Quite a lot of the time, it doesn't work. It just randomly, sometimes it works and it produces some of this material. And this material is incredibly reactive and blows up with a single photon. But the rest of the time, it's just completely dud. Now, suppose for some health and safety reason, I have to be sure that when I stick this explosive at the bottom of the building, that it's actually proper material. Because if it's dud, yeah, I don't want to stick it there and then go back and then find it's not dud and it blows up. So when I put it at the building, I want to really know that this is going to blow the building up. Because I don't want to put dud stuff there. So I want to get rid of all the dud stuff. Well, there's obviously one way to get rid of all the dud stuff. We shine a light on it. And if it doesn't blow up, it's a dud. The end problem is the good stuff has all been blown up as well, so I can't use it to blow up my building now. That's a problem. What am I going to do? Well, obviously, the answer is I should put it in an interferometer, shouldn't I? It's all logical. I take some of my stuff and I put it in an interferometer and I shine my light. Oh, what happens? Well, if it's dud, then nothing happens. It just passes through, the photon doesn't react at all, it arrives, and it interferes, and we get this interference pattern on the screen. And interestingly, there's this point on the screen in which no photons arrive. Well, what if it's not a dud? What happens then? Well, one possibility, if it's not a dud, is it blows up. Yes? This particular kind of material, yeah, it's very crazy. Duds don't interact with photons, they just go straight through. They could introduce a phase shift, I suppose, but that would just move the interference patterns. But mainly, it doesn't blow up. Well, of course, it could blow up, but it blows up with a probability of 1/2. What happens the other half of the time? It goes the other way. It goes the other way, and it arrives at the screen, and it arrives, possibly, at this point. And there can't be any interference because effectively this hole has been blocked. So this point on the screen, if we stuff our thing in here and a photon arrives at this point on the screen, what can we conclude? It's a good bomb. We conclude it's a good bomb because had it been a dud, this point would have been forbidden by the interference pattern. So it can only arrive there if it's a good bomb. Why? Because if it had met the bomb, it would have blown up. But it didn't met the bomb because the bomb didn't blow up. And they seriously have done what are called interaction-free measurements. Obviously not with bombs blowing up, but with actual systems to test this out. Well, going back to nasty, horrible equations now. Okay. We got to this point and we said, okay, this is nice. We've got these two things, they don't actually affect momentum, but they still can be used to measure which way the atom went. And measuring which way the atom went involves looking where the photon gets deposited. But we waited until after the atom got to the screen before we went and had a look. Now, we actually did look where the atom went into the screen. We noted it arrived here, and we put a tick, wrote down in our book, it arrived at this point, and then we went back and we checked where the photon was. And why am I emphasizing this? Because, well, let's suppose we didn't go and look where the photon was. Let's suppose we recorded everywhere where the atom arrived, each time, click, and we took the box, each box each time, and we took that box away. So we've got one run of the experiment. We shine a light, an atom arrives, it goes click, we know where it is on the screen, we write down a number, we write down run one of the experiment, it arrived at this point. We then take the boxes with the photon in from run one of the experiment. We stick a label on them. We say, that was run one. We go and take those boxes and we put them in the corner. Then we run it again. We get a new click, different position. Experiment two. We note down the position, experiment two. We take the boxes from two, we stick them together, we put a label on them. Run number two of the experiment. We go away and put them in the corner. We do this a lot of times. We find we get this, which, you know, although we haven't separated that into two, which is what we were expecting. We got these in the corner. And we think, let's be really malicious. We can rewrite these equations. So we have these different wave functions that we can have for the photon. Now, this is just a linear superposition that we can write out. It's very easy. But mathematically, well, we can show, for example, that these are orthogonal to each other, and we can show that they're normalized. And we can put them into that wave function. Let's see if I can get this one right. So, our first one we have is we have our phi u g our e u right. What we need to do is to note the following. We can rearrange them the other way. So we can just simply take those two equations and we can add and subtract them, and we get our original wave functions for the photon. But this enables us to do something else. We can now take these two equations here, and we can substitute them into our original wave function. Now, there's nothing mysterious to this. It's just doing manipulation of algebra. There's no action taking. Nah. Okay, well, we can. What happens is here, if you have the, well, let's take an example, the EU0, ED1, for example. So we take EP, we subtract EM, and what that gives us is 1 upon root 2 EU01, 1 upon root 2 minus EU01, but that's got a minus in front of it, so that's plus. So that gives us 2 over root 2 EU0 ED1, and then we multiply by 1 upon root 2, which gives us 2 over root 2 times 1 upon root 2. So that gives us 1. So, yeah. And when we substitute that, we get another equation. And we can just write this one out. If we try and put those into here, we get there. And what happens here is rather interesting. What we've got is a phi u, phi d, and a phi u minus phi d. We can try and write that one out, but it's just basically we'll write a lot of terms and we'll cancel the plus and minuses. Now, it turns out the interesting thing, the reason why this is possible, why this is interesting to do, is because this EP here and this E minus here does correspond to measurable properties of the joint box, because I just did another trick. I made that disappear. So we go back to a box in the corner, a couple of boxes in the corner, which had photons in, and we take out our box that's labeled experiment one, and we know there's a photon in there. But what we can do is, rather than saying which side of the box is the photon in, it turns out there is a measurable property that says, is the photon in state EP, or is the photon in state EM? And we can measure that. And then, well, that's exactly the same calculation as we've done before. What we do is we take our EP, and we star that, and we multiply it by this, and then we integrate over our Y. That was that. That's just this equation over here that we've got on the blackboard. Well, the EP, EM are orthonormal. So the EP star and the EM go to 0 because they're orthogonal. Whereas the EP and the EP go to 1 because it's normalized. So if that gives us, if we measure and we get EP, the state of the atom is this. Now this was the 1, 0. If we'd have measured the 1, 0, we'd got probability 1/2. We already know this, we've done it, right? And we got psi u g. And this would be the distribution we've got. We know this, we've done it. And if we'd have measured in the 1, 0, 0, 1 basis, we'd have got a half a chance of getting 0, 1. And that would be corresponding to the atom going down the other route. And we know this, we've done this. And this would have got that. And we add these two together and we would have got this pattern. And we say, look, we measured the direction the atom took. And because we measured the direction the atom took, the interference disappeared. Well, what if we instead, we measured this EPEM, this E to P, E to M, or Psi P, Psi M, this. Well, with probability 1/2, we would have found it in the P state. But the Psi G plus Psi D, Psi U plus Psi D, well, this is the one we did originally. This was our original interference pattern. That gets us this. So we take our boxes from our experiment, and we pick out a bunch of these boxes that we put over to the side. And we measure them in the PM basis. And every time it says P, we go away and we go back to our listing of where the atoms arise. So we pick out a box from experiment 14, we measure it, we get P. We go back to our list of where the atom arrived, and we look up experiment 14, and we look where the atom arrived. And when we find we do that for a whole bunch of boxes, that we got the answer P, and we look at where the atoms arrived, we find that they do indeed show the interference. Half the time, of course, we don't get P. If we measure EP, half the time we get M. So let's say, you know, we pick out the box from experiment 27, and we measure it on the PM, from the PM basis, and we find it says M, the photon is in state M. And we go to our experiment 27 and we look where the atom arrived. Where did it arrive? It was in this state, and it arrived. And it had, and we say, this interference pattern. Now, why is this so very, very, very odd? Yes? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the thing is, we took the photons, we put them to one side, and we looked where the atom has arrived. So the atoms had arrived at this screen. They'd arrived at this screen and noted and be recorded where they arrived long before we decided whether we wanted to measure 1, 0, where the photon arrived, or whether we wanted to measure this PM state of the photon.
Yeah. was taking down, that has taken down the split or the lower split.
Yeah.
Okay. And now what we're doing is, say, we're splitting the box into an up and down condition instead of our right and left.
Right. Well, what we have is the actual details of the experiment are, you've got the box, and the box is in two originally.
So we have this original box, and it had a gap in it. And if we had the photon is there and not there, or else it's there and not there. And, you know, we seem to think that if we found the photon here, then the atom must have gone through the top slit. And if we found the photon here, then the atom must have gone through the down slit. But if instead of doing that, long after the atom has gone through the slit and arrived at the screen, we measure this PM. So what's this PM thing? It seems kind of an odd thing. It's this rather weird function over there. Well, there are various different ways you can do it. In the actual experiment they've done, it turns out that what you do, if you remove the center of it, you can have it so that the photon gets absorbed or doesn't. And it gets absorbed by an absorber on the side of the box if it's in the EP state. And it doesn't get absorbed by the side of the box if it's in the EM state. Now, there's other ways in which you can set up this kind of thing. So you could have a difference between polarization of the photon, for example. So this could be polarization in, say, a horizontal direction. And this might be polarization in a vertical direction. So there's a lot of different ways you can represent this. The actual physics depends on particular things, but yeah, you could try and you could picture it as being left and right. I don't know of any actual individual experiment that really works in terms of it being left and right as opposed to up and down. What's important is the P doesn't distinguish between the up or the down. It's pretty much symmetric between them. And the M is pretty much symmetric between the up and the down. So if we go back and, oh no, it's not on there. Well, if we were to go back and look at the definition of those. Yeah. What's clear is that the up and the down enter equally on an equal footing, and on an almost equal footing, give or take a minus sign. So there's a symmetry between the up and down. So there's no way of telling from P whether it went through the up or down slit, and there's no way of telling from M whether it went through the up or down slit. And that's what that's what allows us to go, oh, well, you know, we still don't know which way it went through the slit. And lo and behold, when we don't know which way it went through the slit, the interference pattern reemerges. Ping. But this should be very worrying, and this should be very startling, because if we measure the P, and then we get this interference pattern, there's this point on the pattern that the atom isn't allowed to go if we measure P. And this point on the pattern depends on the phase shift in both parts of the interferometer. So, how? But on that same run, that experiment 27, we can take the box from experiment 27. We know where the atoms arrive. We can measure this basis. And if we do that, we can tell which way the atom went, allegedly. But if we measure PM, we can get an interference pattern that it absolutely 100% guaranteed is not going to arrive at this point. And if it doesn't arrive at this point, depends upon the details of the slits, of both slits, on a phase shift in both slits. So somehow it really, really has managed to go through one slit and go through both. Somehow, how is the atom supposed to know to avoid that? At the same time, we can find out which path it went. The problem is, if we find out which path it went, we're not going to be able to split this up into the interference patterns. But remember, the atoms arrived at the screen long before we decided which thing to measure on the photons. So when was the decision taken? When was there a measurement? If putting those boxes in the way had caused there to be a measurement of it being on one side or the other, then there wouldn't have been interference. The wave function hadn't collapsed. Well, it's been suggested that this, the real complementarity, the real duality, is not between position and momentum, it's argued, it's about the information we gain. So if we are going to do an experiment that gains information about which path the atom took, then we won't see interference. And if we're going to do an experiment that tells us, that doesn't tell us which path the atom took, then we can see interference. And that certainly seems to be borne out. But can we do an experiment that does both? Well, it's been suggested that we can, in what's called a delayed choice experiment. And in some extent, the experiment we've just talked about is what's called is a delayed choice experiment, in that we delayed the decision of whether measuring up-down or plus-minus PM until after we'd recorded where the atom arrived. Well, there's another way in which we can delay it. We have our interferometer, and we have our atom, and it's coming through, and it's heading towards the screen, and we know it's going to make this interference pattern when it reaches the screen. So what we do is we take the screen away. And we remove the screen after we're pretty damn sure that the atom has actually gone through the slits. And, well, we have to do it a bit clever, and we have to focus the beams a bit in order to make this true, but it goes away, and we know that if we send a wave packet from here, it follows this path. And if we send a wave packet from here, it follows this path. And if we have the superposition of both, well, it just combines and we find that we detect over here, we detect over here, and these two turn out to be exactly just the sum of what happens in the individual two cases. So we pulled the screen away, and we said, if we detect it here, then we knew it went from that. And if we detect it here, we knew it went from that. So we've got this delayed choice. We could have had the screen and we would have had interference. Or we pull away the screen and we get to see which path it took. But we can leave the choice until after it's gone through the slits. So how does this poor atom know what it's supposed to be doing? Is it meant to be going through a wave, going through both slits? Is it meant to be an atom going through one or the other slits? It seems that we can actually leave this indefinitely. We can leave it as long as we like, and we can even register some things like where it actually arrives on the screen, and then still leave it to decide whether or not it had gone through, so it had been a wave going through both slits, or it had been a particle going through the other, just one or the other. And the guy called Wheeler expressed this as saying, look, and this guy was a follower of Bohr, who said, the only way we can really understand this thing is we just give up any way of actually talking about what this poor atom is doing. That quantum phenomena are just not understandable in these terms. What we have is we have an experimental apparatus. We have an arrangement, we have a way of calculating what's going to happen if we have that arrangement, and we go out and we build the apparatus and the phenomena appear, and lo and behold, the phenomena that appear is what quantum mechanics predicts. But talking about what's going on in between is just talking about stuff we can't see at all. In the end, you know, we have just different experimental arrangements. One of them is we stick the boxes in and we measure the M and the P. One of them is we stick the boxes in and we measure the zeros and ones. One of them is we pull away the screen altogether. Each one is a different experiment, and each one produces different phenomena, and that's the only way we can understand it. And we shouldn't talk about the phenomena except in the context of an experimental arrangement and a specific individual experimental arrangement. And he said, no phenomena is a phenomena until it is an observed phenomena. That is, we shouldn't talk about it in outside of just doing the measurements. A few years ago, a guy called Mohammed Ashfar came up with an interesting variation on this. He removed the screen and replaced it with a diffraction grating. And the diffraction grating had this interesting property. It was only present where the interference pattern said the particle couldn't be. Now this has an interesting result. He then put detectors out here, and he found that whether you have this grating there or not, you could take away the grating or you put the grating there, didn't really alter the intensity at which particles arrived at the detectors. And this could only be because the particles were avoiding where the grating was. But the only way the particles could avoid where the grating was is by having this interference pattern. And the problem is that the interference pattern only tells you where to avoid if you have the information from both slits. So you are apparently getting an experiment here in which if you detect it here, you know it came from this slit, but along the way it managed to avoid places that it only knows how to avoid by having gone through both. And Akshar said, look, I've got an experiment here that shows wave and particle behavior in one and the same experiment. And he actually said, this says that Wheeler's position is rubbish, that you can actually find these two things at the same time. Well, one of the things that you get out of this is a superposition just simply cannot be understood as being a mixture. We've got these superpositions, and you can try and think of these things as being a mixture, but the rules of probability just don't add up if you try and do that. Something is going wrong with that. Find at X is not the same as be at X. Quantum mechanics certainly seems to be telling us what happens when we look for things, because it gives us these results when we go and look for them, and they're there where it tells us they're going to be there, and they're not at the places where it tells us it's not going to be. And they're the places it tells us it's going to be at the same rates that quantum mechanics says. But we have a problem. Well, what happens? The observed phenomena seem to depend upon the apparatus in a very odd way, in this kind of delayed way. We can actually indefinitely postpone deciding what kind of experiment we're actually doing. Times when objects are supposed to behave in a particular way as to whether or not they're deciding to be a wave or a particle, or know about which slit, or know about both slits, or neither slit. But that's happening, the decision is long after they've gone where they've gone and arrived where they need to arrive and been measured there. And then we decide that they have to have gone through both slits or have to have gone through one slit. When is the choice being made? And you could just leave it at saying, well, look, let's just, we set up the apparatus. But a number of people think this is not really good enough. And one of the great critics of this point of view is a guy named Bell, who has a quote here. It says about quantum mechanics, it's just, what can you have as a theory that's just about results and measurements and says nothing about anything else? How can you have a theory in which we just abandon any picture whatsoever and just say, well, we set up an apparatus and we see what happens? I mean, he particularly thought this is particularly bothersome for cosmologists. Because for them, they're dealing with a system. They want to do quantum theory, but they want to apply quantum theory to the entire universe. How do you do an experiment on the universe? Well, you set up some apparatus and you put the universe in it. That's not going to work. If the system is the whole world, where do we find the apparatus? It's us, but we're in the world. We're in that quantum system. And he particularly said, well, you know, what? When is a measurement, when is the choice made? When is a measurement performed? Does it have to wait around for something to observe something? When do we get to make the choice? When we are looking at quasars in the distant galaxies, one of the examples that cosmologists have used is lensing effects. Now, there are various kind of optical interferometry experiments that can see interference in photons that were emitted in the distant past, tens of millions of years ago. And we can do experiments now that see interference between the different paths they took to get to Earth. Is the reality of what happened tens of millions of years ago actually genuinely going to be decided by decisions we make as to what we're choosing to measure here and now? It seems a rather implausible position. But this is where it seems to be driven. So, well, there's a lot of different viewpoints on that, and we're going to start encountering them in the next day, on Thursday, in fact. But just for now, I'm going to mention another experiment. all the time we've been saying something, it said quite frequently, it's told that this is just the one object. We send the object through one item at a time. And it's the single quantum object that does interference, and the photon doesn't interfere with itself, with other photons. Well, they actually did an experiment called the Fliegel-Mandel experiment in the 1960s, in which they took some low-intensity lasers, well, coherent things. They had to be lasers to actually get really, really coherent light sources. And they set two separate lasers, and they run off independent power sources, and they turn it down to a very, very low intensity, so a single photon would come out. So in any given time, there would only be one photon in the experimental apparatus. So it's very, very low chance. You would wait a while, and there'd be a click. And then you'd wait a long while, and the while you'd wait would be a lot longer than it would take a photon to travel across the apparatus. So you're fairly sure that one photon's being emitted at a time. But they're two completely independent sources. And they've still got interference. When they didn't measure where the photon was. And they had to go to quantum field theory to try and explain that one. Because they had to say, well, look, if you had different sources, it's supposed to be they don't interfere. But actually, it's even more complicated. When you go to quantum field theory, you can get interference from sources, from different sources, as long as those sources are sufficiently coherent. Any questions? Pardon? Okay, thank you for that. I missed a bit about feedback. I just heard that it sounds like shit. I thought that was some feedback for me, I thought, for a minute. I'm afraid I can't help with the feedback. I'm not saying anything. Can you hear anything right now? Can you hear me? Okay. Well, it seems to be intermittently working. I can only hope that by Thursday the system's working better then. We can... Certainly, yes. I'll have to hand that over to the course organizer.
Okay, so what we have at the moment is a band that can bring up to 10 people. Okay, so we will have something for you guys.
I know. So I don't have at the moment the name of the person, but we will have your email addresses. So hopefully we will be able to send you an email, and the guys who want you guys, if you want to come here. We can bring 10 people every Tuesday and Thursdays, okay? I promise that we will try to do a better job with the projection and the transmission to you guys. I know that for a while you were only seeing the screen, the computer was projecting, but you couldn't see Owen showing with the hockey stick where he was pointing and so on. So we tried to fix that problem. Hopefully it was fixed. I don't know, so can you give me some feedback as to how is the system working? Yes, so what we're going to try is that on one of the screens, you see the computer, what is on the computer, and on the other one, you only see Owen walking and doing things and jumping up and down as he was doing it here. But you guys missed it. Okay. So something else is that the whole lecture is going to be online. Okay. So I think in the next few days, you can go and click on the lecture on the webpage. I think it's through.
Okay, very good. So, so Jacob, can you please try to point here? Can you see that now? Okay, well, why don't you read it? Yes.
The website reads perimeterinstitute.ca. That's the standard Perimeter Institute website. And then it's /scientific/courses/New Horizons in Fundamental Physics with underscores. And you should actually be linked from the main page.
Yes, actually, if you follow the main page, you go to courses, and then you will find the course there. You will get to the web page. I'm sure you guys are smart and you will be able to figure it out. So there you will find a link to the course description and also to the schedule. All the information is going to be there. The problem sets are going to be there. And, well, I'm not sure if the link will exactly be there to the lecture itself. But you will be able to find it on the web page in something that we call PIRSA, which is a Perimeter Institute something, I don't know. Recording system or something.
That's spelled P-I-R-S-A.
That's right. That's right. Very good. Okay, so let's thank Owen again.